All right, Rico, long time no see, man. Yeah, at least me.
You've been ignoring me for 2 years.
Well, you've been hiding in a cage as new chief software architect for Visual Studio, and you were unable to talk about what you're working on.
It's true. It's been a while since they wanted me to really come out and talk about stuff. We were about to launch VS 2008, and so it's not such a good idea to talk about Visual Studio 10. You know, when we just released a product. So really, it's with PDC and TechEd, we had our big coming out party, and so now's a good time for me to start talking about how we were thinking about VS 10 and you know, what's in there and what I'm worried about or whatever else. I mean, I understand there's a bunch of questions we got from the community. We popped up a bunch of those.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting to see what people are worried about and what they're not worried about. It's not always the same things that I'm worried about.
Interesting.
So I guess that's a good thing.
So let's begin right there before we jump into Niner questions. And I think we should focus a lot of this interview on their questions, because it's something that the Niners have wanted was a little bit more interaction with the people who actually work here.
Sure. Do you have a list, or you want
to
go?
We'll go through there. There's some that I'd like to hit first, and then we'll check that out in a second. But as the chief architect of Visual Studio, certainly performance is still high in your mind.
I haven't forgotten about it.
So, what are you thinking about? I mean, how about that for a question? What are you thinking about for the future of VS?
There's a bunch of things we were thinking about, but. Okay, well, one that people are gravitating around is WPF, right? You know, we took a big bet on WPF in this release.
Okay.
And I wrote about that. I said kind of, you know, who thinks... I do this thing for crowds. Raise your hand if you think GDI is the last word in computer graphics for the next 10 years. Okay, nobody raises their hand.
Yeah.
Nobody raises their hand because people think, you know, okay, that was very nice, but it's you know, it's very 80s. And so what we want to do is make a set of investments that let us do the kind of user experiences we want to do for the next 10 years, not for the last 10 years. You know, if you look at VS 2008, which I love, by the way, don't get me wrong, I love this product, I use it all the time, I think it's fabulous. But it looks a whole lot like VC98, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and like I say, if you showed it to your mom, could she tell you which one was the 2008 product? She may not be able to. So we need to be able to have a more modern look. That doesn't mean radically changing everything. Certainly not all at once, but you know, what's the opposite of radical? I mean, you know, we've been very kind of, we have the same look and feel we've had for a decade, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make changes there, and so that means embracing technologies like WPF, because it'll give us flexibility that we want, right? And make us not have to do, you know, like if I have to write one more WM paint handler, okay, I think I pretty much had enough of that. So we could do a lot more. So great, okay. But what about perf? Lots of people are like, well, if you go WPF, isn't it going to be slow? But like, one doesn't imply the other at all. Okay, what are we going to do? If we take WPF, certainly it means managed code is going to be on the startup path, right?
Yes.
And in the current IDE, you can kind of defer managed code from startup, but really only if you kid yourself, right? Like if you're doing any WPF development yourself, for instance, or using the managed stack, you're going to pull in the CLR pretty darn quick, because a good chunk of the IDE is already written in managed code, and you know some of our systems have significant managed pieces. So okay, but strictly speaking, it wasn't on the startup path, and certainly WPF wasn't on the startup path. And many people know, you know, if you've used I keep saying CIDR, but I mean the WPF designer, right?
Yeah.
The WPF designer, it's obviously uses WPF.
Yeah.
And it has a startup hit associated with it, right? So what are we doing about that? And if I put WPF on the startup path, doesn't it mean I'm going to take a startup hit that's comparable to the WPF designers? Well, not necessarily, right? I mean, it really depends on how many elements we use and where we use them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not so much of a fatalist as to say that I'm doomed if I so much as touch WPF. I don't think that's true at all. I think we can help them tune that startup path. They've been doing work on that. I think we can expect to get improvements from the CLR in startup and in engine stuff, the same kind of stuff that I used to talk to you about years ago.
Yeah.
And that'll help. But I am expecting to take a startup hit. I'm not Notepad. I have no delusions that I'm going to compete with Notepad startup time. That's not my game.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that even if I say out the gate that loading WPF is going to give me a hit, and I want to keep that hit fairly modest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the warm cases, I'm talking about maybe 300 milliseconds. I mean, that's what I'd like to see. Now, okay, what I'd like to see and what actually happens are two different things, but, you know, I'd like us to see, like us to be coming up and are ready to go.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on there for a second. Yeah. You're the chief architect.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that. That's one of the things I also wanted to have in this interview is when I sent you the mail, I wanted to, what the hell do you do now?
Yeah.
So if you're chief architect, that means that, yes, I understand, it doesn't mean that you're the king and you get to say, this is what we're doing. That's what Soma does and Guthrie does and all these other executive types.
Yeah.
But you get to basically map out.
I give a lot of input.
Of course. Of course.
I mean, like, it turns out they have me here for a reason. You know, do you want me to switch to this question or finish answering the previous question?
Sure.
Okay, how about I finish up with the previous thing real quick?
Sounds good.
Okay, so we're going to take a bit of a startup hit, but I also know that there's a bunch of fat in the IDE. There's places in the solution system and in the language services system where we can get savings. And so I think overall, by the time you open up a solution, I can pay back a lot of that time that we hit in WPF. And I don't want it to be the case that we're doing such crazy things with document trees that it's a big hit. Like in the text editor, for instance. Yeah, we're going to use WPF, but, I mean, what's in a text screen? You know, it's like a couple thousand characters. Well, okay, that's not 2,000 text blocks. That's a lot less. And you could be darn sure that we're not going to take an entire document and turn it into WPF elements all at once, right? We're going to do what's on the screen. It has to be virtualized. I mean, if we did the reverse, it would be a total nightmare. So
exactly. If
you think about, okay, we're going to make some elements. They're going to be corresponding to what's on the screen. There's going to be adornments on that screen. And, you know, a limited number of adornments, whatever is visible, then, like, exactly how much drawing are we talking about and how different is it than the GDI cases? And so so if that's the case, and we are talking about, hey, it's not making a WPF representation of every piece of text you have everywhere in your document, it can be pretty darn good, I think. And we've shipped this editor before in Blend, and so, you know, folks are a little bit worried about it, but I don't think they should be worried about that. I think some of this other stuff is more interesting. So let me dovetail back to your other question. Mm-hmm. What I own is the technology roadmap for the product. I own it. That's you know, Soma doesn't get to say what the technology roadmap for the product is. That's what he pays me to do.
Okay.
And, well, I guess he can tell me I'm an idiot and fire me, but, like, hopefully that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, as long as I'm not a complete screw-up... Mm-hmm. I own the roadmap, and I own it jointly with the other architects. So what do? Well, I work with my colleagues. We look at what are the most compelling problems that we face. We look at what we think we're going to need to do over the next 10 years. What investments do we have to make? And sometimes we say we have to do some infrastructure work. Like, for instance, in this version, we're going to make our shell WPF. You know, that's something we've talked about. Okay, so... well, that's great. What are we going to do in WPF? Well, probably it'll be pretty modest this time. You know, probably the shell won't look a whole lot different than it looked like before. And, you know, I mean, we'll do some things, you know, when I, you know, don't want to tell you what's under the Christmas tree exactly. But you can expect that everything that you could conceivably do in WPF in the shell space, that's not the goal here. What we're trying to do is get the right technology underneath us, get some wins, yes, because it's difficult to just do the technology for its own sake. But... it's not just about this release. You know, at the moment that they put someone like me into the picture and said, we need a technology roadmap, we started having a 3-version plan for things, at least, you know. Mm-hmm. So I have things mapped out for VS12 already, you know, and even VS13 in some cases. Well, what are we going to do? Well, where's that going to go? Where do we have to be in 10 years? It's a big product. We can't, you know, we can't just turn it around and, oh, let's make everything WPF in one release. I mean,
sure.
That's nuts. It's like upwards of 45 million lines of code. So we have to kind of remodel the thing. So, well, what do we do first? And which are going to be our most acute problems? What are we doing for concurrency? How are we solving some of our you know, STA-related issues? You know, we've got a bunch of code that was written, you know, assuming one thread and whatever. And, you know, well, that can't stay that way forever. Well, do we change it all at once? Well, that's nuts. Mm-hmm. So we need a plan. That's why we have a roadmap. And so the people, the Scott Guthries of the world and the Jason Zanders of the world, they look to me to come up with a choreography, if you will, of, well, how should we invest? You know, when do we invest in what? What are we going to need? And how do we make it so that 5 years from now we're not wishing that we had done some foundational kinds of investments 5 years ago? I mean, you know, I have to make choices now that are going to serve us for the future. And so, well, additionally, there's some challenging problems that require a lot of thought and cooperation from a bunch of different people that are immediate needs. Like, we're doing multi-targeting in a big way in this release. Like, seriously multi-targeting. We've done it in the past, but in a more limited way. All the multi-targeting we did for instance, Framework 2.0 versus 3.0 versus 3.5, they're all based on the same CLR, right?
Sure.
Well, that's no longer the case. I mean, in some... You know, I mean, some people think we already did multi-targeting, but we kind of finessed it, like, because the platforms were very related one to another, and so you could kind of do this onion skin model. Well, that's not the case with CLR 4.0. We have a whole new tool set. So we have to be able to have solutions with multiple different things in them. We have to have projects that are targeting the old framework and the new framework in the same solution, launching different sets of tools. Well, there's a whole set of problems associated with that. How do you make that work in, say, you know, the WPF designer? Okay, well, you know, or in a variety of other places. How do you make persistence work? When the build runs and you need to do serialization, well, you have to serialize for the correct framework that you're building on. Well, Visual Studio is only running one of those frameworks, right? So someone else has to do the serialization for whichever the other framework is. So some stuff has to get pushed out of process. Well, there are a lot of problems in that area. So we spent several months kind of looking over, okay, we have to do multi-targeting now and forever. So, you know, let's get that right. Let's make it so that when the CLR team wants to do a new release, they don't have to, like, you know, come begging across the street to get all this infrastructure built. We have to kind of be a lot more decoupled. So so we did some things like this. We defined a bunch of initiatives very early on. You know, like maybe the second week I was on the job, I had a meeting with, you know, the other Visual Studio architects, and this was one of those things where it's hard to know what we were going to agree on and what we weren't. But I thought, okay, well, it'd be good to set up a common sort of foundation. And so I wrote on the board a bunch of things that I thought were inescapable. And I started putting, you know, stuff like, okay, we're going to have to embrace WPF eventually. You know, we're going to need some to go. We're going to need to have multi-targeting. You know, our editor needs a facelift. And, you know, we need something that scales. We need incremental loading of solutions. We need, you know, so I made a list that there were like 9 things. I don't think I could recite them all on nine to you. And those were things that basically we could look around the group and everyone would say, we have to do them. There's no, you know, never mind what I like or what I don't like. They're like, if we don't do those things, we're going to be screwed within the next 5 years. So... the core of that turned into what's happening in Dev 10, and some of them are going to have to wait for Dev 11, you know, and so we have to pick and choose and balance, and then meanwhile we have to continue delivering value because we don't get to just go dark.
Understood.
So I don't get to pick exactly what. I don't. And of those initiatives, we had to look and say, well, what's harmonious with what we need to do for the business? Mm-hmm. What's harmonious with what we need to do for the platform? Where are our user experiences weak? What's going to be harmonious with that? What's just so acute that we must have it from an infrastructure perspective? So if you look at the kind of the combination of what we're trying to do from a user experience perspective, you know, from a platform perspective, from a customer, you know, which customer segments we want to target, then you get kind of the overall plan. And cool. And that is, you know, that's quite a little dance. But it helps. You know, having someone like me means that the team of architects has a voice, right? Like, rather than being a bunch of eclectic guys with a bunch of eclectic opinions, we kind of talk about some big issues, we come to consensus, and then we can sort of make, you know, I can go to SOMA and say, look, the joint recommendation of the architects is blah, you know, and this is what we think we have to do. And that's, you know, that carries a lot of weight. Now, that's not the same as an edict, but he's like, wow, my architects think this is a big problem and we got to handle it. So, you know, he'll start talking to his staff about, well, are we resourcing that kind of thing? How does that balance? Mm-hmm. You know, are we putting enough emphasis on the right priority? You know, and it helps people to make better decisions.
Excellent.
I've said many times, you know, you've heard me say it, being an architect puts you in the decision improvement business, right? So that's where I'm at. You know, we have to make product plan choices. We have to decide how to marshal our resources, right? And I want to help us do that better. And the way that I do that is by making it clear where we're going technology-wise for, say, 10 years, and kind of what steps we're going to take. And then, you know, people can kind of chunk that up and, you know, pick and choose from it in about the right order. And so good things hopefully happen.
Great. So now, speaking of some of the people who, I know that you are an architect who actually really sequesters customer feedback, because in the end, if developers aren't using Visual Studio, then who cares what kind of brilliant things you guys come up
with?
That's
true. I have no customers, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know,
kind of moot.
Absolutely. So let's take a look at some of these questions. And I already told them that we can't ask all of them, but what I think would be fun would be, let's try to answer these in a short period of time.
Okay.
As short a period of time as you can. So, you know, let's see. Stebbit is the first guy that asks. So, Stebbit, we will ask your question first. So let's look at his first question.
Finally support multi-monitors. Can you elaborate on more detail than that? Okay, so the main thing that we want to do in this version is, like, let you take advantage of that screen space.
Mm-hmm.
So traditionally, the everything that's like a document is in the center of the MDI frame, and you can't pull it out at all. Okay, so that's where we want to go. Like, we want you to be able to, whatever document you're looking at, you can pull out tool windows, right? So you can pull out the Solution Explorer, put that on a monitor, but you can't pull out your document. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, so the thing I most want to work out, I can't pull out. So anyway, so we're fixing that. You'll be able to take anything. If you see it in a tab, you can pull it out and put it on a second monitor, and that'll let you spread your work, you know, wherever.
Excellent.
And then you get key mapping. And so you could maybe have your class diagram over here, and then your code over there, and maybe some debugger windows or, you know, whatever. But the debugger windows you could already move because they're tool windows.
Sure.
But your document windows you couldn't. So now everything can be pretty much anywhere.
Awesome. All right.
The second part of this, are we moving to a ribbon-based UI? We don't like the ribbon for our product. In fact, there's a... Interestingly, they did a sort of a case study of who should use the ribbon and, you know, the office team. And we were like the classic example of a product that isn't going to get much bang out of a ribbon.
Okay.
Partly because we're spreading over multiple monitors, and we don't have this sort of I'm a document and I'm about a piece of paper format. Mm. It gets to be like a long way to drive. To get to the, I mean, it literally, you could go up here to, like, and concentrate more things across the top. It seems mm-hmm. kind of bad. So, like, what you really want to do is have more things that are kind of immediate, more action menus, more, you know, more right-click, more, like, do it in context, associate with narrowly with the window that I'm in, and have the infrastructure that I want more at my fingertips. And so that's more the direction we're going to tend to go rather than the ribbon direction. But this is really a conversation you want to have with our UX team.
Sure.
If they told me build a ribbon, I'd build a ribbon.
Great. Well, that question's done. Let's move on to something else.
Any plans to integrate Visual Studio with Expression Web and Blend for creative professionals? Oh, there's lots of integration already. They share assets and so forth.
Uh-huh.
You can see that the Expression Suite is getting more developer features, right? And they're going to need an extensibility model. And my shell is going WPF. And they're so, I mean, can you kind of see, you know, already there's a lot of overlap? I think it'll begin to make more and more sense for us to share componentry. The crucial thing is I can't sacrifice that user experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they were to pick up the shell, say, in VS 2008, it would have been limiting for them, and it would have been difficult for them to create the experience they wanted. So as we have the fundamentals for them, I think they'll be able to pick up more and more of our technology stack, and I think that's a good thing. I don't think customers should notice, except for that more things interoperate better.
Great. You know, thanks for the question, Raymond. We move on to the next one.
Visual Studio integration with upcoming languages. F-sharp is going to be supported. What about the different scenarios, such as ASP.NET? What about upcoming dynamic languages, Iron Ruby? We like to have tooling support for all these things.
Sure.
That's important. I think we'll do even more cool stuff around dynamic languages. Other people want to see a REPL, and maybe we might talk about REPLs. I think actually that's a question that hits that squarely later on.
Mm.
So yes, we should have support for every language that we think is important. We already have some support. Some of them are tricky. Like, how do you do IntelliSense in a dynamic environment where you don't know, like, If the type's not statically bound, it's hard to do completion after a certain point without evaluating, and then it's hard to evaluate without taking side effects, right? So it's kind of problematic. So we'll always have different kinds of support for different kinds of languages, whatever's sort of appropriate.
Great. Thanks for the question, LTR.
I'd like to see more granularity when installing it. So would I. Do you know what the difference is between the complete install and the typical install?
Yes.
You do?
Well, not
what
much.
What is it?
How much time?
It's the 64-bit compilers. That's the difference.
Okay.
The 64-bit native compilers.
Sure.
I think we could do better than that.
Yeah, well, that's what I meant. So
we have
the timing differences.
Yeah, it's
not
like nothing. Well, the content is, I mean, you know, it's like the product is this, you know, and the difference is like this. So we would really like to have something in that space, and I'm hoping to see something there. It's something that, you know, it's something I've made a lot of noise about. And
so, I mean, just to say, Tom's question sort of echoes other ones, and that is something that we've talked about. And I remember having this conversation with you about 2 or 3 years ago when Scoble was still around. We came and did a tour. The bearded fellow who was a CLR architect, I think he's still on the team.
He's still here. He's still
the
Jim Miller.
So the question that I remember asking him 3 years ago, I believe, is like, why not componentize or modularize this giant virtual machine, which becomes even more giant with the base class library associated to it?
You mean the framework? Yeah.
The framework. I mean, why don't we... So I guess one question to ask was, is there thinking, Mr. Chief Software Architect, about making, you know, the ability for on-demand services for the framework? In other words, I don't want to load the whole freaking thing.
Okay, but now you're talking about the framework rather than VS.
Fair enough.
So,
it's now we're in a different world.
It's dangerous for me to speak for them.
Thank you.
I'll tell you what. We cannot keep adding features to the framework forever. Okay? It's already got, you know, lots in it. Mm-hmm. And every time a new platform comes along, the answer can't be, okay, we'll add it to the framework. I mean, that just doesn't work. And equally for Visual Studio, every time a new platform or application model comes along, we can't say, oh, we'll just add it to Visual Studio. Like, if you look at what the XNA guys are doing, for instance, they have their own application model and their own set of things. They ship on their own cadence. They're comparatively separate from us. They pick up whatever the latest version of our tooling platform is, you know, when they want to, pick it up and run with it. Lots more things need to be on that model. Because if every Tom, Dick, and Harry who wants to ship an application platform at Microsoft has to knock on my door and beg me for a cup of tooling, that just isn't going to fly. So, and even more so, we want within our own building, even right here at home, for more and more of our components to behave, as Doug Hodges put it, we should be behaving as if we were a Visual Studio extender partner, the same way that our partners think. We should be shipping, you know, the base core tools, and we should build on top of them, and our own guys, like the C-sharp team, for instance, could have the C-sharp language packages and so forth. They already have this to some extent, but they could be delivered in a fashion that was very, very independent. Now, we're not there today.
Sure.
But that's something I'd like to do. And that would give us more setup for flexibility, servicing flexibility, deployment flexibility, lots of different things. It's the kind of thing I think about. Okay, so remember what I said about the chief architect doesn't drive the product plan, so that's not... I didn't just promise you that I'm doing independent SKUs, you know, okay, but...
Well, that's cool. I mean, I want this to be clear, too. I mean, this is Channel 9, man. You've been on Channel 9 for many years. Channel 9 is not a marketing place. We're not making promises. We're having a technical conversation.
Yeah. So I think those things are important.
Great.
And I think they're equally important to the framework guys because they're going to have all the same problems. I mean, our problems are you know, very symmetric
cool.
in that regard.
All right, so enough on my dumb question. Let's get back to the smart people. So what else is Tom talking
about?
I'd
also like to see Visual Studio in the Windows SDK adopt PowerShell rather than CMD.exe. That's very interesting. And PowerShell, you know, they use a lot of our components in the new PowerShell UI. That's apparently the latest CTP is getting rave reviews, and you can see some of our componentry. Ultimately, I'd love it if PowerShell was actually completely Visual Studio shell with the PowerShell language in there. And, of course, the experience is different, but lots of the technology is the same.
Cool.
Which would be great because if you had a cool editor extension, it would work in PowerShell and it would work everywhere. So, you know, I think more synergy there is great. Getting rid of CMD.exe is problematic for legacy reasons, but having more people having a higher quality shell experience, it's kind of hard to argue with that.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think we can do better than CMD.exe in 2008, but... you know, I guess there's still a place for old reliable. I don't understand why after 8 years we still don't have a pseudo variable in the managed debugger to represent the return value of a function. Wow. I can always look at EAX. Actually, there was a little pseudo thing for the native code where we do return. We wrote that way back when and a long time ago, when I was the debugger lead. Like, it seems like a previous life. We added the notion of creating a pseudo variable that captured what we were about to return or what we had just returned. That's kind of a low level thing. So I want to talk to Brian Crawford and see like what he's doing in the managed code space.
Sure, that's fine.
You know, I think it's a good idea. I'm surprised we don't do it too, I guess.
Great. All right, thanks, Tom, for your great question. Let's move on to someone else now.
Okay, out of curiosity, approximately what proportion of the managed to unmanaged code? It's about half and half, I think. I'd say we're about half managed. From a tooling perspective, maybe, you know.
So what you're saying is Visual Studio is written in half managed code.
It's about half managed, okay. I bet. Yeah, and it depends on, you know, like how old it is. The newer stuff tends to be managed, and we're trending more in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I bet you that active development is about half and half. The new editor will be managed, more of the shells managed, more WPF stuff. We have lots of legacy services, not legacy. It's not that old, you know, mm-hmm. but we have lots of services that are COM-based. And of course, you know, they're mostly native, and
sure.
But not even all of those are native. You know, some of the editor services are now being via COM interop, actually managed code that you can access via COM using the published APIs. So and about half and half.
Okay.
Let's see. What was the next question here? Thoughts on Ribbon. We talked about Ribbon.
Yep.
Code editor and refactoring capabilities are getting better. Third party tools are kind of necessary. Are we deliberately leaving tool rooms?
Yeah, now, that's a good question.
That's a great question.
So let's talk about that, because a lot of people sort of frown upon our refactoring. I mean, every time I go to JAL,
they always
tell me that. Like, now, if you use a real refactoring application,
yeah.
Visual Studio is great when you add this add-in.
Yeah.
So let's talk, let's jam on this.
So, we want to do more in this space, okay? There's no question. I mean, we have, what, three refactorings? Or is it four? Okay, whatever. I can count them on one hand, okay? It's not that many. And, okay, thank goodness we have some of the most important ones. But, you know, we don't have, like, a jillion refactorings. And so, okay, we need to do better here. So there's no question. Now, on the other hand, you know, the writer says, do we like to leave room for people like ReSharper? Well, yeah, we do, actually, because we don't want to have to build everything. I mean, we like having an ecosystem. We like that other people can engage, you know, with each other, and, you know, that we don't have to do every little thing in order for people to. So, of course, you know, there's a certain amount of, should we do 10,000 refactorings? Well, probably not. And there's other things that only we can do uniquely, like that enable this for a bunch of different people. So I'm a lot more excited about creating more common language services across different languages. Anders has already talked about at PDC that, you know, we're doing bunches of new things in the compiler, and you know, we're looking at doing managed versions of the compiler and maybe using that for new and interesting language services and having dynamic languages and having more commonality between VB and C#, and you know, there's a bunch of stuff there. But think about this, okay? If you're doing refactoring and you're in the Java world, what language do you have to refactor? Java.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're a Visual Studio and you have to do refactoring, what language do you have to
X.
Yeah. We support a jillion languages. And, like, some refactorings are kind of the same language to language. And you can imagine, well, if we had one consistent language model, well, that would be great. And we could transform and everything would be fabulous. But that is certainly not universally true, because I'm looking to see how I refactor, you know, F# with the same tools as C#. That one's going to be pretty tough for me. So, okay, but right now we have, like, almost no shareability between those things, and it handicaps us, right? Because we really like to be able to have a lot more things where it is common between, you know, kind of the more conventional managed languages, if you will. All the procedure-oriented ones are, yeah, I don't know, like the ones that feel like VB or C# or have good connection to those,
sure.
You know, leaving out the F# of the world. Those ones could potentially share a bunch of stuff if we had a more common language representation, okay? And so that's something we'd like to have,
mm-hmm.
You know, and it's on the plan. But like,
great.
That's, you know, this month, you know, I don't know.
Cool.
All right.
So let's go down. Thank you so much. Who was that? Boric B?
Boric B.
Thank you so much. Let's head down to AI. Is that AI or AL?
AL. It's Al.
All right, Al.
It's Al with a little A. MEF is a big deal, so I'd like to hear more technical stuff about that. How do you manage the add-ins? Just through the file system? Can I enable disable them? Can I control how they load? Can I have two add-ins that do the same thing? Will it blow up? Okay, so part of that is MEF and part of it is us. So let me kind of... you manage them as simply as possible. We want it to be the case that you can basically run a very simple installer that lands them in the right directory. We'll notice that new ones are there. If you have custom add-ins enabled, you'll just get them. If you're running elevated, then there's some security issues. We don't want to want you. You'll kind of have to opt in a little bit. But modulo the right settings. You basically drop the thing into location and we'll load it. Now. At that point, MEF will have done its job for us. We'll find the thing, we'll discover its imports and exports, and it'll get plugged into the appropriate subsystem. When you sort of author an MEF component, you have to say, what subsystem is it going into? Which catalog does it participate in, and which imports and exports does it wire up to? So, like, project extensions don't go into the editor, right? Okay, fair enough. Now, that's all the MEF part. The other part is kind of, well, how do you do space negotiation? Like, if two people want to add a margin, can you do that? The answer is yes, but that's not an MEF feature so much as it's an editor feature. It has to take the add-ins and compose them. So if multiple people want to add coloring, we have a model where they get invoked in a certain order and they can each layer in. If multiple people want to adorn, we have a way that they get, you know, the adornments get activated and it all happens in a very sensible kind of way. The idea is that these can be composed. Now, you could imagine some MEF components that are just completely not missable, okay? I mean, I don't know. Like one thing that's trying to take the entire top of the screen and another thing that's trying to take the entire bottom of the screen, and when you put them together, there's nothing left. So now the editor's useless. So, okay, great, we loaded them, but it doesn't work. Well, okay, you certainly can't guarantee that every combination of things works well together in Visual Studio. You can't even guarantee that in World of Warcraft. Okay. You know, so yes, but technically... lots of extensions can be composed. Mostly it will make sense to do so. Sometimes it'll be weird because they're not really, they just don't work well together. And loading them and running them just, you know, you get a terrible experience. But
cool.
As much as we can, these things are supposed to be composable. It's very important. That's why you don't just like subtype the editor. We didn't want to make it so you could just derive from the editor because only one guy could do that, right? Like, what about the second guy who derives from the editor? How does he work? So we have this kind of multiple extension points, multiple models. That's something I want to do pervasively, by the way, not just in the editor, like in everything going forward, you know, so that you can do more compositions and more finer grain stuff. Because I don't want people to have to write packages as the only way to extend the IDE.
Excellent.
You know, for
and you talk stuff. About this in your blog, and you yeah. also, Dan came and interviewed you and another fellow, and you basically talked about that.
My boss, Paramesh, we have an interview from the VS Extenders conference that, you know, maybe we can, when we post this, we can cross-link them.
Absolutely. All right, so too many smiley faces, Al. We're moving down.
Right? Okay.
Just kidding.
Some other questions?
Yes.
Let's see. WPF, have the use of WPF in the new designer influenced the .NET 4 platform? Yes. Of course, one of the reasons we want to take WPF dependencies is because we want WPF to be worthy of use in a flagship application. That's super important. Let me ask you, why? Well, because I don't want WPF to be some power toy that you use for sexy-looking calculators. What the heck is that? Mm-hmm. And we do have medium-sized applications like Blend. Okay, you know Blend.
I do know Blend.
Great application.
Yeah.
The existence of Blend made WPF so much better because it pushed the envelope on what you can do. Well, we got Blend. Blend works. It's a great experience. We have other expression sites. Now let's try driving a flagship down WPF Boulevard. Okay, this is Visual Studio we're talking about.
Yeah.
So if we can put Visual Studio on WPF and demonstrate that you can be successful with a flagship application...
Mm-hmm.
That's real goodness. And I'm sure we're going to shake out some issues. But I'm telling you, the WPF guys, they are mano a mano with us. They really want to do this.
Excellent.
They think it's absolutely the right thing to do. And they will fall all over themselves to make sure. Like if they're, I don't know what it is, but if tomorrow we find some cosmic problem with WPF that is causing Visual Studio to be undoable, you can expect an army of WPF guys will figure it out. you know, and that will be one less problem for anyone else who's trying to do real WPF development. Mm-hmm. We've had pretty good success so far. I mean, you know, we still have to vet some of our perf numbers and make sure we're not being dumb. A lot of it is just, like, we have a bunch of GDI experts, mm-hmm. you know, and they know the best way to do GDI development. Well, we have to learn WPF. You know, I've been, like, the last couple of weeks been looking at the virtualization stack thinking, okay, well, how do I do this? And, oh, I want to do composition. Oh, can I use the virtualization? Should I use templates or, you know, what's the best way to do this? I mean, I kind of have to go back to square one, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh my goodness, a long time ago when I was reading the Petzold book, you know, mm-hmm. and learning about Windows and what's the best way to write a paint method. Well, you know, we're kind of back there again because we have to learn about WPF, but it'll help, you know, mm-hmm. it helps WPF, it'll help us, and there'll be more examples out there.
Outstanding, so, man. I look forward to that.
Well, me too. And we can do new, cooler stuff. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, maybe not all right away, but... let's see, feedback on the current CTP, not so much yet, it's very, very new, and new plans for Team Suite, pricing, okay, I'm sorry guys, I'm not going to answer pricing questions. Lots of people like to know what the deal is with the pricing of Team Suite. This is not an unpopular question by any means, and we have to figure out...
But you're not in the business of pricing.
Yeah, I don't do pricing, this is Channel 9, so, yeah. You know, I know that they want to hear about it, and somebody somewhere knows, but not me.
Okay, fine, let's move on. Who else do we have down there? Thank you for your questions, Al.
Thank you, Al. We have Vesuvius.
I think he's replying to someone. Does he actually ask a question?
And Scott Gusilver, he mentioned Silver Lake Designer and Visual Studio Developer. I think you can safely assume WPF is one. Okay, yeah, so he's talking about...
Now he asks a question.
Now is a question. I would like to know why he thinks the Ribbon UI is... And I should actually argue against it. Interesting, you know, he's talking about the same kinds of things we have. It's Ribbon isn't necessarily the right metaphor for our thing. Mm-hmm. And we have proximity issues. And we also have heavy keyboard users, too. So yeah. It's kind of... You know,
Ribbon's not in the plan. It's not that interesting.
Not right now.
Okay, fine.
I mean, you know, I reserve the right to be wrong.
Fair enough.
Ask Rico why they've opted for a folder with a clock in the Visual Studio 2010 start page. Does it not denote recent documents, projects? To me, it's the icon. Overhaul of the icons in Visual Studio. Yeah. Well, first of all, that start page is customizable now. Because it's just WPF. You can put all kinds of... Well, you put whatever you like on it. Yeah. You take our start page and throw it in the trash.
Yeah.
And just, like, whatever you want, knock yourself out. Cool. If you hate our icons, don't use them. So you can make it whatever you want. It's literally a hunk of XAML, right?
Perfect.
So you can... Whatever you want it to be. Now, I don't know that we are at the point where we have final art. So I don't know. But, like, I don't know. From icons, I mean... Whatever, it looked like a fine icon.
All right, Max, thanks, Vesuvius.
But change it. Make it what you like.
Now we have a long-winded one here.
What will Visual Studio do to improve code comprehension? In this version, some stuff from the language teams. In the future, those new language compilers are set up to be running independently so they can be used in a variety of contexts, having more of a coding model. That'll help a lot. I think we'll still look to third parties a lot for really the high-end code understanding features. But I think also they're going to get a ton more flexibility. I mean, these poor guys have to do so much work to make the editor, the existing one, do what they want it to do. If we take that yoke away from them so that editor integration is no longer a problem for them, and, you know, if they want to underline things, they can underline them, and if they want to, you know, whatever tracking they want, and they'll have a better substrate, they're pretty excited about that. So that means they can focus on their core business, right, and not focus on, like, how do I get a glyph in the middle of the, you know, why is it so hard to put a warning label in the middle of the text? That stuff should be very easy. So I think we'll get more. I think it may still come from third parties. I'm not completely familiar with the VSL's plans.
Okay.
REPL. When do we get a first-class REPL in Visual Studio? That's a great question. Now, there's two kinds of REPLs because people don't always mean the same thing. And I think what Joe here means when he says REPL is he wants the dynamic programming environment, you know, kind of a la Python for what he's building. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he wants a REPL for his code, and presumably, like, as he's working in the REPL, he wants to be able to maybe cut and paste the parts he likes and put them in a document that it's preserved, you know. I used to do dynamic programming a lot when I worked with Maple a lot in school, and Maple's a dynamic programming language for mm-hmm. symbolic computation. And then it's kind of funny, I came from that to Python and other stuff, so, but you have this sort of way of working, you know, in the REPL model, where you kind of accrete your code and build up the different pieces parts, and then when you get to something you like, you say, okay, well, I'm going to need to be able to rebuild this or deploy it. So, you know, you persist some of it, or you snap it into a text buffer that you can replay, or, you know, there's various tactics. So we'd like to be able to do that. We can do that kind of thing with the dynamic languages comparatively, you know, that's not like super, super difficult.
Okay.
But the other kind of REPL that sometimes people want is, like, they want a REPL for the IDE itself, like kind of the command window on steroids, right? So they want to drive Visual Studio with, I want to write macros for that drive Visual Studio. And so I'm in this window making the IDE do things, kind of like the embedded Python environments that you find in some applications now. So there's, like, the one kind of REPL that's over here targeting the program that you're building, and the other kind of REPL that's over here targeting the IDE itself, you know, mm-hmm. and maybe even indirectly. Like, you can imagine this REPL is driving the debugger, which is debugging that, you know, so it gets all very convoluted. So one of the issues for us is making sure that the experience is nice and separate. So if you're running some stuff here and you create an infinite loop in the REPL by mistake, it doesn't bring down the IDE, well, that's less of a problem if it's the app, because we could always suspend the app, but then we have to come back. So there's lots of issues around the dynamic programming area.
Okay.
Many of these issues are at their most acute in the thing we call VSTA, the our macro solution for, you know, Visual Studio Tools automation, the thing we do for Office.
Okay.
That's where those investments are happening most heavily. And that technology isn't even in Visual Studio right now. We use this old thing called VSA that we obsoleted, I don't know, 82 years ago. So we want to get on our own latest macroing and REPL answer, and then we'll start having the same kinds of modern features that Office has, and then we can start using them for both flavors, and we won't have this, you know, nutso kind of thing. So my answer is get off of VSA, get on VSTA, adopt the more modern things. We should get the best REPLs we have to offer, and then we can upgrade those so that they're the best in the world, and then we win.
Okay, great. So let's move on. Why? Let's do a why question. He has three subsets here. So that was a what. We give him a one what, one why, and one how.
I want tools for extracting as much useful information. I think, though, no. See, he's talking about his why are, like, why is he asking these questions?
Oh, okay.
So really it's kind of, yeah, and I read this before. So let's take the third question.
Sure.
How will MSDN evolve with Visual Studio? A new help experience in this version.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the indexer myself, actually. There's a help indexing piece that I helped write because, you know, I needed a project and they needed some code written. So anyway, so we have a new experience. It has a WPF viewer. It's very incremental. It's much more lightweight than the old one, and so we're going to age out dExplorer. The storage is much simpler. It's basically zipped up HTML files at this point with an indexer around them. So authoring them couldn't be easier. You know, you could just, like, basically make zip files and stick them in a directory, have them be indexed, and we'll find them. So it should be much, much simpler for people to build and deploy help in the new version. There's a metadata convention for how you describe where you want to appear in the table of contents. We build that up on the fly. It's designed so that it can be incrementally updated, so you don't have to take a 20-minute hit. And we're also really wanting people to pick the docs they need. So, like, I'm pushing very hard to have it be the case that we don't install all the docs by default. That's a big chunk of time right there. You know, it takes, like, 20 minutes today to index the docs when you get them. I mean, you know, and a lot of the docs is stuff you might not even use. Like, if you're a managed developer only, you know, I mean, do you really need the Windows CE native toolkit you probably don't, you know, and you might get the docs for it in the default. So I'd like to have that, you know, going back to that setup thing. It's the components, it's also the help, lots of things where we'd like to give you what you ask for and make it easier for you to ask for less. A lot of people don't use the... I mean, we have lots of breakdown now. You could imagine going through the thing and unchecking a bunch of stuff, but it seems not very popular to do that. I don't do it. It's too much of a hassle. You got to find all the things. Do I want this? Do I not want that? It's very so something a little bit more in between might be good.
Is there any thinking of sort of an integration with help documentation and the instance of the text editor that I'm currently composing in? So, for example, I want just show me a freaking sample. I don't want to go to MSDN, man. This is the new age. I'll make a web service call. Stick it in my code.
I'll tell you what. Here's the beauty, okay? With the I don't know that we're doing that, but you could. You yourself could on top of our editor. We did a demo at PDC because we didn't talk about VS much at PDC at all. We didn't want to make the PDC about VS this year. So if it was up to me, of course, it would have been all about
VS.
Well,
it's PDC 09, isn't it?
But okay, fair enough. But we did this demo where we took the XML comments in your code, okay, where you have the formatting, and we replaced that blob of text with a beautifully formatted, you know, thing that had the code description and the arguments and all that stuff, and hot links to the bugs even, right? Because where the bug notes are there, we hot linked them to TFS.
Cool.
Scott Guthrie wrote it, so you know, I mean, if Scott can do it,
anyone can.
Right? Yeah. And it had these beautiful WPF gradients and all that stuff right in line with the text. Now, okay, let me just—I'll give you, tell you a secret. Okay, that isn't the only WPF stuff you could put in. It could have been other stuff too. Mm-hmm. So, like, suppose you wanted to make a hotkey thing add-on that adds a help adornment. So that when you ask for help in situ, it goes and does a web search and then presents the results and sticks them right in line with your document after doing a web service call. So you could totally do this.
Cool.
You could do whatever the heck you wanted. Stick it in an adornment. You can do it in two. There's two big flavors of adornments. You can do ones that are kind of in line with the text, and you can negotiate for room, right? So you could say, give me a little room before this line or below the line so I can put my thing, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing you could do. Or you could do them so that they're relative to the view. So you could do like a HUD. So say you wanted, you know, you're like a, you know, you're a gamer head and you wanted to do your HUD because you want to feel like wow. So you could do this like semi-transparent help discoverer thing so that like every time you cursored over a word, it would in the background go and do a MSDN lookup and then like overlay right on top of your text. I don't know, maybe this isn't such a good idea, but like you could do it.
Yeah.
You could overlay right on top of your text like the help display that you wanted, mm-hmm. Maybe a piece of it, and have it right there, you know, and then as you scroll the help stays in focus because it's like it's a HUD, right? It doesn't move. The text scrolls and the thing doesn't move. I need to silence my phone. So
that's a cool sound. All right, so let's move on to page 2 after the phone has been silenced.
Okay.
2 pages of questions. Good job, Niners.
And we forgot to thank whoever that was.
Oh, let's
thank
go
you.
Back and thank him. I'm
whoever,
sorry.
Whoever you are.
Those are a good thought.
Joe Chung,
good thoughtful stuff.
Thank you, man. Thank you, Joe. Okay, I use Visual Studio. This is Dave Developer, day in and day out. Thank you, Dave. And I've been using it since the first version. You have? Wow. That's a long time ago. I mean, I wonder what he means when he says the first version. Does
probably
he,
the first version. Well, it's a hard. I don't know. I can't speak for him.
Yeah, does he? I wonder if he means 2002? The same thing that I would mean. Yeah, he probably means 2002.
I doubt it.
Yeah, yeah. I was using VC1, right? Which is the first thing I'd call an IDE that we produced. Well, some people would say VB1, which came like the year before, was the first IDE. So,
okay.
But anyway, okay. Long time. Thank you, Dave. In many ways, I feel that it has lost its way as a tool. Oh no, I'm excited by that. It was it used to be. No, we haven't lost our way, really. We're all too often features. I'm back in the only reason I found little features that delighted me. I look like I'm driving a semi-truck. Okay, new questions. We keep seeing new tools, to be outside of VS, the end-user experience is much more exciting, these tools, US functionality. What are your thoughts about taking these tools out of VS and putting them in their own experience? Very interesting. Okay, so we want to share a lot of technology when we do that because we don't want them to have independent extensibility models. We want them to share solutions and projects. You need to. One of the great things about Blend is you can do a build. You could do the full VS build inside of Blend, even if though you never looked at a piece of code yourself. Mm-hmm. Where we have independent pieces like that, we want them to have common assets. You know, so we don't want to reinvent the editor 3 times or have 82 different versions of the editor. But we also want people like Blend to be able to create their own unique experience. And so that's why we're doing things like the WPF investment overall. We want to give them flexibility so they can be on top of the shell. They can get all the benefits. They can get our undo manager and our running document table and blah, 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 blah. They get all that stuff. And they get to have, I thought I silenced this thing. And they get to have their own experience, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is. And so we don't want them to have to compromise on their experience just because they're using Visual Studio technologies. So we have an isolated shell offering, and that's going to get better and better. People can use it for whatever. And I think over time, our suite will be a combination of things that run very tightly together, like Visual Studio, and things that are a little bit more loose, like Blend and other kinds of things, where you know you want that separation. Mm-hmm. But there's benefit in having them wired together, because when they're wired together, you get integration possibilities where one can react to activity in the other, and you know one and one makes three, right? So yes, we like some separation, but also we like some integration, and you know there's kind of a pendulum there that swings back and forth. You know, remember way back when in VC1, the tools were completely separate. Do you remember App Studio was totally separate for resource editing, and you know all the tools ran out of process, and you know browser analytics they were out of process. I mean, all kinds of stuff was out of process because that's the only way we could do it then. And then we kind of swung towards very integrated, and now we're kind of, well, maybe we should move back a little bit. So
cool.
So yes. When is Visual Studio going to focus on someone besides Mort? Oh, so many of the college grads entering the field aren't excited by Visual Studio, and so they go on to work on other tools that are designed for the hipster developers in Silicon Valley. Okay, well, all right. Now, I love Mort, but I love Einstein too. Yeah. I think one of the things we're trying to do is create more opportunities for differentiation so we can do this stuff. We think about scale. Mm-hmm. Right? That's a huge thing. We think about a modern experience for everybody, not Mort and everybody. I want there to be power tools, and I want people to be able to, for instance, I'm expecting a whole renaissance of editor customizations. When people get their hands on this thing, they're going to do every little thing, and they're going to have more fun making power toys for their environment. Because, I mean, people have done editor customizations in the past, but those were toys compared to this. We're not talking about some macros that do interesting text manipulations. We're talking about being able to create entirely new user experiences in the context of the editor. It's kind of like, excellent. You know, like what Olay did for Word, okay, we're doing for our editor, right? And it's just the beginning, you know, and so I expect we're going to see some really cool stuff. I don't think we'll be able to look at the brand E IDE and say, oh, our editors are comparable after this. I don't think so. I hope that people find this a very compelling environment to work in and they start building tools for it. And I don't want to have to be the one that builds every power toy. You know, I think that doesn't work, right? I mean, it turns out there's people out there with good ideas and I don't have them all. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, much as I'd like to pretend that I do, yeah. It turns out I don't. And so we need to enable others to do this. And so, you know, we're embracing extensibility in a big, big way.
Excellent. All right.
Well, the last one here is I see Visual Studio being more of a semi-truck in terms of a vehicle. Are we going to have a light, fast, aggressive Porsche Prius version of Visual Studio? Well, we do have the Express for SKUs. Mm. Now, I'm all for being frugal, but at the same time, I'm not Notepad. Don't get me confused, okay? I've said it before. I have no desire to compete with Notepad. Notepad is Notepad. I think I start being able to add value when you have a few files, at least. They need to be managed. We have some interesting problems around those things. We have a build that needs to happen. You know, at very small scale, you know, well, heck, you could pick up anything and it works fine. Use whatever editor you like and use MS Build that ships with the Regist and have a nice day. I mean, yeah. You know, do you really need anything? So we start having something to say when the solution is of meaningful size. And the more complexity you have, the more important it is to have tight tools. So there's a certain tension. I mean, I don't want to load the kitchen sink. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I do want to make it so that as you use things, then they come into play, and you know you don't have to pay for them just because they exist. But at the same time, I don't think my sweet spot is two files, you know, and so I think it would be a mistake for me to design for that, you know. But on the other hand, I do turn the screws on people from a performance perspective of saying, look, you know, why are we loading all this code? None of these systems are active yet. You know, why are we loading these designers? You know, that none of those are active yet. We have to make sure that we stay, you know, we stay tight and frugal. When I listed the the attributes. They were extensible, modern, connected, scalable, frugal. He's talking about frugal, right?
Okay.
Be small in a small case. And I'm hip to that. I don't want to waste, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think the design point for us is larger. But I use C# Express like half the time in my daily work because it comes up faster and it has the features that I need. And it's fine. You know, it's a fine little product. So
great.
You know, which isn't to say Visual Studio isn't a fine product too, but you know, there's plenty of times.
All right, so let's look at the next question.
I would like to hear about 64-bit version of VS. I know it's not going to happen in the near future as VS is based on COM, but still it would be nice to know what MS is doing in this regard. Okay, good question, Powell. Oh, and thanks, Dave, developer. Okay, many people have asked me about 64-bit. I'm not that excited about 64-bit, and it's not because of COM. We could do 64-bit COM. I think a large-scale port of the, you know, Visual Studio is pretty large, of all of it to 64-bit would be very expensive in terms of manpower and just getting it right.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't necessarily deliver a whole lot of value. Many people who say, well, I'd like to see 64-bit support, what they're really asking for is they want us to handle larger solutions and work better at the high end because they're not satisfied with the performance. And they think, hey, if we had more memory, we would be able to do the job. Well, I don't think that's the answer. I think the problem is that for some of these large solutions, we're not making especially good use of memory. And we're using way too much memory. So what I'd really like to do is change our algorithm so that we're more lazy, we're more pulling in what you need and only what you need and not loading all this stuff all the time. And if we do that, we could reduce our memory usage considerably and then we'd be able to scale a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, today, you know, maybe I'd get some immediate relief if I went 64-bit, but only if you had like lots of memory. When you compile programs 64-bit, they get bigger. I've written about this before in my old job. You know, the pointers get wider, and so your data structures get bigger. And, you know, the magic numbers, like, you know, depends between 1.2 and 1.4. Okay, that's how much slower your code is going to run just because it's 64-bit. Now, because the caches don't get bigger, so you'll get more cache misses, and the same data will take more space. So you need to pay for that. You need to pay for that by saying, okay, yes, I'm going to take a little bit of a tax, but since I'm going to fit all in memory, I'm going to save on page faults, yada, yada, and overall I'm going to have a great strategy. Now, for Visual Studio, some parts of it, I think, would benefit from being 64 bits. Not all of it, but some parts of it. And because we're package-oriented, the strategy I want to take is to make it be possible for you to take packages of Visual Studio and make them 64-bit, have them run in a 64-bit process on a 64-bit machine,
mm-hmm.
and then do communication to them, and those guys can have all the memory they want. There's some very compelling cases for that. Analytics, for instance, where we're talking to the 64-bit data engine. But a wholesale port to 64 bits, I don't think people would get what they wanted. And also, doing it all at once like that would be pretty expensive, and we'd almost have to go dark and do nothing but convert code to 64-bit, which I don't think is especially a great thing to do. Now, the other tension is, the code is slowly but surely being converted and managed. So, you know, like if you look at the mix. So it's starting to be the case that a lot of the product you could recompile, you know, you could run on the 64-bit CLR and expect lots of it to work. There's still probably porting issues there too with serialization or whatever, but it's not quite the same. So, but it's not even really the porting burden that I'm worried about. It's like, what would I get at the end and does it make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But I have to be mindful, right? You know, people are talking about, well, what about the 64-bit server environment? How do I run there? And, you know, what about if I'm designing for 64-bit? How do I get a great 64-bit targeting experience? And what about macros for 64-bit? And, you know, there's other kinds of things. So we need a 64-bit plan overall.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think an immediate conversion to 64-bit is the right thing for us. I think we'll start looking more strategically in Dev 11 at, like, what should we do and what are the costs and what should we do in what order, and I'll start getting it on the roadmap.
Cool.
But, you know, immediately, people really have to be mindful that there's a cost,
mm-hmm.
Both in performance and in porting, and you don't necessarily get something better if you're not using that much memory. I mean, if
so
you need the memory, by all means.
You're not going to hang it right on Route 64 until Dev 11. Time planning.
Yeah, I'm not. I think we'll start. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean,
cool.
In Dev 11, we'll start looking at it.
What do we got?
So thank you, Powell. Will we see decent support for Windows installer projects? This feature hasn't changed since DSNet 2002.
This is Zippy. He's kind of an angry guy.
Yeah, he does look kind of angry, doesn't he? He's got that avatar from The Incredibles.
He's a longtime Niner.
Yeah, okay. And the full capabilities of the were never used, like patching.
Yes, so.
You know, didn't we do something with Wix in the community just recently, kind of making it out there for CodePlex and stuff?
Yeah, Wix is out there.
So I think that's our answer, is that, you know, we're making Wix sort of broadly available. We're going to keep investing in it. Mm-hmm. We use internally a flavor of Wix, you know, like there's, because, you know, Wix is extensible. So there's a bunch of stuff we put out there for everyone, and there's some extensions we have that are just for us that are kind of not really very exciting if you're not Visual Studio. And I think that's all. Well, that's all that I know of.
Okay.
So there might be more, but certainly I haven't been thinking about Windows installer projects that much. So, yeah, I wish I had a better answer. I think our Wix plans are pretty much, you know, as good as that's going to
cool.
get.
So go check out the Wix stuff, Zippy.
Yep.
Well, hey, we answered all these Niner questions, and so I lied and said we weren't, but we did.
That's because I talk fast.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, it was good to be trying to, like, to be snappy. Usually, you know, I'm not good at directing interviews. I have a question.
Okay.
We've spent a lot of time on Channel 9 over the past year. Digging into the concurrency problem.
Yes.
The advent of ManyCore. Now,
yes.
Besides creating libraries, I know the great Joe Duffy and that whole team, Stephen Tube, all those guys over there.
I got his book right
it's
here.
It's a great
can
book.
Can I plug his book?
Yes.
Yeah.
Awesome book.
Yeah.
They're working on sort of a library approach to solving,
yes.
making it easier for general purpose programmers to write.
A bunch of stuff that.
But what about you as an application? Taking advantage of a 1,000-core machine, because they will be coming, and so that you increase compilation speed, that you increase whatever. Let's talk about what you're doing from the infrastructure of your application to target ManyCore.
I lose a lot of sleep over this issue, so I'm glad you brought it up. No, it's good. I mean, they pay me to lose sleep, right?
Uh-huh.
So if this job were easy, then the pay would suck, and so anyone could do it. Okay, so I'll tell you what. The thing that's killing me the most is that a lot of our code, I kind of mentioned this before, a lot of our code is based around STA.
Okay.
It's fairly old. It's not reentrant. So what I've been doing is trying to put us on a plan where we tease apart the various parts of code that we have. The storage parts, you know, like in speaking in model view controller parlance, okay, that's the kind of separation that I want to see long term. Some of our view technology needs to stay STA because the display technology is tightly STA, and STA helps you with causality, right? Like, if the guy types ABCD, it would be really bad to insert DBCA just because you decided to schedule those things asynchronously, okay? You need to preserve causality so that things happen in the order people expect. Great. And that helps with interaction. But we want to do things like background compilation, background syntax check, background profile runs. Well, how do you do that? Well, the underlying stores that you use for your system, like the text buffer, okay, like the language model, like the solution, okay, these things are, quote, models in the MVC parlance. Those I want to be concurrent. They can be multi-threaded. They have to have a transaction model so that people can consistently make changes. They have to have an isolation model, like a database, so you understand what happens when multiple people try to use the thing. A lot of times we fail in this space because we don't learn the database lesson. We say, oh, we'll have transactions, but we don't talk about isolation. And so then, like, what does that mean? Two people try to change the thing. What do you see if you view it? The thing I talked about in my blog recently was on our old editor, in order to give a stable copy of the editor buffer to the compiler so that it could compile for IntelliSense in the background, we have to copy the entire buffer every time you type a keystroke, right? That's the only way, because the compiler otherwise might be looking at a buffer that's changing out from under it while it's compiling, which is a catastrophe, right?
Sure.
Okay, well, that sucks. I mean, I think we can do better than copy the entire buffer. So if the editor, now the new editor doesn't have this problem. The new editor uses a micro snapshotting model. So you can say, give me a logical copy of the buffer that looks immutable. Okay, what does it look like at this moment of time? And then you ask your questions against that snapshot. That's a lovely model, and it means that background tools, they can get a view of the editor buffer as though it's not changing. Meanwhile, it's, you know, incrementally making the changes and keeping a log and so forth. But any particular customer gets a stable view of that thing.
Cool.
Okay, we have to do that everywhere, right? It's not just the editor that has to do this. All of our key data structures have to be enabled so that they have this lovely, you know, capability to have multiple clients on them. Sometimes I say it's like client-server model, but all in the client. You know, so like you can imagine the document as a server. You can ask it questions. You get consistent view. You can, you know, give it. You can say commit these changes and so on and so forth. So, all of our systems have to have that feel. And now we have a separation of concerns. We have some pieces over here that are still entangled with STA, and they kind of belong in that world because they're about user interaction. And then we have pieces over here that are multi-thread capable. Okay, where a background services can be simultaneously accessing them. Okay, and so there's where your cores are, there's where your jobs are, there's where your background compilations are happening. They're just on the data. There's maybe notifications from this world to that world, you know, so that the updates happen in a timely fashion, they get queued up, and, you know, we have job control or whatever else. And in between, when you make certain gestures, they may cause synchronous operations on the data, if that makes sense, because it's a short-term thing and you need the answer immediately before the UI can proceed. Mm-hmm. Or they may queue up asynchronous work against those stores. Okay? Either way, you get good separation, and where asynchronism is allowed, you can start to see it. Now, this is not a transformation you make to the code in a half an hour. But the beauty of it is that you don't have to do it everywhere to start getting benefits. If some of our designers, maybe some of the older ones, they're not used as much, if they're not very multi-thread aware, oh well. Okay? But if our core systems, you know, in the most important places, if they become more separated with disentanglement between the views and the models, then we get concurrency where we need it. We can disentangle more things as we go and keep doing it in that pattern. And over time, all the important things will have this lovely separation of, you know, here's the storage model, here's the primitives, here's the UI. Let me do the work in the background and let the UI catch up. The UI is just a client like these other guys, so it has to get a consistent picture too, right? Because mm-hmm. you don't want, you know, to be painting and or parsing or coloring and suddenly, you know, get wonky views of the data that can't possibly exist. So you need this sort of self-consistency across the thing. That's the overall plan, and that will help. You know, that and just eliminating dumb stuff. We have no shortage of threads in Visual Studio, as you know. We have, like, on average 16 threads or something. But it's like a relay race. Our parallelism is very, very low because it's like we have 16 runners but only one baton, you know. And so, like, one thread hands off to the other thread and the other thread hands off to the other thread and, you know, and then they watch. And so we got to, like, this relay race has got to go.
Yes.
And so, but that doesn't have anything to do with Joe Duffy's primitives. That's just, can we be less dumb in some of these areas and just kind of take care of those things and, you know, do the work that's necessary.
Well, it's an architectural problem.
Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. I mean, sometimes it's literally, like, there's just a bug where somebody fixed a bug by adding a big fat critical section somewhere where one didn't need to be, and you're like, you know, dude, there was a better way to, like, not have a race condition there than putting a giant critical section around the thing. So I'm like, okay, I guess some of them are architectural issues, but some of them are just
implementation
just
problems.
Don't do that, okay? Yeah. I mean, you know, like, learn to not lock. So we have all of those. I mean, it's a big code base. A friend of mine, she said, I was having a bad day. You know, sometimes a good day.
Absolutely.
I was having a bad day. And I said, wow, you know, things are not going well. And she got all worried for me. She was all defensive. And she says, well, what, did they saddle you with a whole bunch of problems in Visual Studio? Like, is the code base awful? And I had to laugh. It cheered me up. I had to laugh. Because I said, well, you know, I mean, thanks for your concern, but holy mackerel, it's Visual Studio. It's 45 million lines of code. I mean, it has all known software problems somewhere. You know, I mean, somewhere there's something. So, yeah, on any given day, I'm bound to hit a problem, and I'm bound to wish that something was done a little better or that, you know, or that a decision that was perfectly good 10 years ago was still good, and I think, wow, I wish we could still do it that way, but that just isn't going to work for us anymore. And so some things become invalid because of the passing of time. Some things are just implementation problems. And, You know, maybe a mistake creeped into the code, or it works, but it's less than perfect. You know, our old editor was fine for the longest time, but like some of the algorithms are, they're quadratic, you know, and so we need a better editor than that. And, you know, like, I don't want to go and find those guys who wrote the old editor and assassinate them. That's not the point. You know, the choices were appropriate for the domain at the time, the size and type of files, and the number of regions we were doing at the time, and well, things have changed, and so we can't just keep using, you know, I mean, would you use the engine out of a Model T?
Probably not.
Well, probably not. But that mean it's a
I'd
bad
take
engine?
The body, though. It's well, pretty interesting
might.
Body.
Okay. But, like, that doesn't mean that engine was crap. It was, mm-hmm. like, a pretty darn good engine for its time. It was an appropriate choice, given the materials and, you know, constraints of the time, right?
Yeah.
So, so you kind of have to put the Wayback Machine to understand. I guess that's an advantage I have, having been here, like, as long as I have. A lot of times I can remember why we did things the way we did them, and, mm-hmm. you know, so we can kind of explain.
Well, that's why you're the right man for the gig.
Some days I feel like I'm the
no,
right
for
man.
Sure.
Other days
you've
I
been
feel
entrenched
like
in this
right
forever. Well, thank you so much. I mean, I've taken up a lot of your time. Looks like you have something else coming up by your office reminder is flashing.
Yeah, always.
Thank you. I think it's great that you answered the Niners question and given us a taste of where we're going with Visual Studio in the
always
future.
Always fun talking to you.
We'll come back and see you, man.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Rico.
Pleasure.